Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In this picture that has caught our attention, a man sits on a terrace between two women, and all three of them are looking in different directions. My friend laughs. It's as if one of them has just said something really awkward. Now we paint them looking down, plucking at their phones. There's a sumptuous light in all of the scenes we're looking at, figures in lit summer gardens, a smell of August heat, of hot grass, somehow visible and rising. Child and father, child and nurse, two women in a rowing boat on a lake, and the woman who looks as though she's been painted en plein air. But really, the lush greenery behind her is a sofa, the wallpaper a sky blue. Here are those revolutionary brushstrokes, those unblended colours that seemed half-finished to contemporaries, as well as the flattened perspectives taken from Japanese printmakers. Impressionism has produced not only a new, but very useful way of looking at things, wrote Marie Braquemond, one of the three great women of Impressionism, as they were called at the time. It is as though all at once a window opens and the sun and air enter your house in torrents. Sun and air flood into the National Gallery, where paintings and prints by these three, Braquemond, Berthe Morisot, and Mary Cassatt, as well as a fourth, Eva Gonzalez, are hung to mark the 150th anniversary of that Parisian exhibition, the one that heralded the start of Impressionism. I love learning about what lay behind this revolution and just how much of it was down to new technologies, new possibilities. First came the trains. So young art students, well, the male ones at any rate, could nip out of the city for the day to set up on riverbanks and in fields. Then came photography. Why bother to paint an exact likeness when the camera captured that for you? Why not focus on light, colour, movement instead? And then there was the physicality of colour, the stuff the paintings were made of. The invention of the paint tube changed everything. Imagine the excitement. The ease of squeezing out pigment rather than having to grind it, mix it with oil, and store it in a pig's bladder tied with string. You could head outdoors with your leggy easel, your canvas, your oils, and in one sitting try to capture light like in a butterfly net. There were brighter paints too, new and synthetic colours as well as the ancient pigments like bone black. Orange chrome, traditionally too expensive for most artists, was now widely and cheaply available, since vast deposits of crystalline mineral chromite were found near Paris. Legend had it that the Indian yellow so beloved of Van Gogh was distilled from the urine of cows fed solely on mango leaves. And the strangest part of this? Forensic tests in 2018 confirmed it. You could be inventive, slapdash even, with unblended colours rubbing up against each other, opposites or complementaries vibrating off and intensifying each other. You weren't just painting local or so-called actual colour, but rather the effect of natural light and reflected colour on a face, a tree, a dress, a lake. Berthe Morisot was known by fellow Impressionists as the virtuoso colourist. Later, she would be the first one to make an early move towards abstraction. She often mixed her pigments directly onto unprimed canvas and went for white on white to capture natural light. Figures dissolved into these light backgrounds. Many of the colours she used were unusual for the time, like the cerulean blue and cadmium yellow that appear in her 1879 painting, A Summer's Day. Here, two fashionable young women sit in a rowing boat. One gazes at us, or rather at the painter. The other turns to look at the ducks on the lake. The park is lush, all emerald and viridian green, the ultramarine and cerulean blues of the lake come alive on a base of lead white, while the soft ochres of the rowboat bisect the painting diagonally. My eye is drawn back to the white ducks. I'm not sure why, until I follow the next diagonal through the water, an imaginary line from eye to object or subject. In fact, they glow. All the movement of the lake seems to dart out from them, as if water is just feathers of light. For days after the exhibition, during the brief glory of an Irish summer, I see the world around me as if it is one of these paintings. In a gesture or turn of head on the dart, flickers of reflected green light on a bare arm in the park. On the beach, a woman bends to her two children, a cobalt blue towel wrapped around her waist, like in a Japanese print, while behind her, deft brushstrokes of wind and intermittent light create the sea.
Hello, Cordia, how are you? First order of business is to put a series of seashells on my foot.
Northern lights invite me, a Costa in a show. Dance burn it down, let me in a gallon. Soon tree, I hear you calling me back home. Yeah.
You were born in Waterford 70 years after Andrew Carnegie laid the foundation stone for a public library on Lady Lane. You spend your early childhood half a mile up the road in a corporation estate where people don't talk about books or libraries or philanthropy. You own a book called Fun with Dick and Jane. Jane's a right goody-goody. And if your brother ever ran into Dick, you'd give him an awful hiding. You can spell the word library, but you've no idea what it means. When you were 8, you moved to a village in County Kilkenny, and that's where you find out that a library is a bus full of books. Nobody knows where the library comes from or when the next one is due. Some fella out bouncing his litter on a hurley will see it coming and he'll shout, and you'll race out onto the road, pushing and shoving to be first up the steps. Last on the bus is a rotten egg. Last on the bus gets Nancy Drew. Your mam has never seen you move so fast. She starts to buy you books about the Secret Seven and the Famous Five. Your dad gets a job in Dublin and you move again. Clondalkin Library looks like a castle, and unbeknownst to you, it too was built with Carnegie's fortune. By now you've graduated from Mallory Towers to Judy Blume. You tell your mam you're going to the library to do your homework. A boy, sitting two tables away, flicks a scrap of his copybook at you. You open it and find a message in red biro. Will you go with me? It says. You uncap your cartridge pen and reply in perfect cursive blue. A few days later, he breaks it off. I have a brutal aim, he says. What he means is this, the note wasn't meant for you. Your mother's favourite writer is Maeve Binchy. You scan the pages looking for sex and are disappointed to find none. When her loans are overdue, she makes you return them. So you wait for the nice librarian, the one who doesn't impose fines. Then you spend your mother's money on a Lucy that you smoke sitting outside the shops on the wall. At 16, your English teacher accuses you of hyperbole, which you take as a compliment. After reading the complete works of Oscar Wilde, you decide to become a writer. In order to become a writer, you must A, get a degree in English literature, B, frequent more libraries, cafes, and secondhand bookshops, and C, read the French existentialists, the American beat poets, and everything written by Milan Kundera. When your literary ambitions run aground, you conclude that life really is elsewhere. So you go looking for it. And you wash up in Brooklyn, a place that's teeming with libraries. You've never seen so many libraries. They're named after a Scottish industrialist called Carnegie, a philanthropist who spent his wealth building public libraries around the world. 66 in New York City, and you're amazed to learn, 80 in Ireland alone. All your life you've lived close to a Carnegie library. And now, on stinking hot summer days, you retreat to the one on Clinton and Union, where you read Shirley Jackson, Flannery O'Connor, and Dorothy Parker. Feeling inspired, you buy a computer and enroll in a writing class at the New School. The millennium turns and you move back to Dublin, where your local library is a neo-Georgian pile with a teak stairway and a William Morris stained glass window on the return. Built in 1913 with a Carnegie grant of £8,500, Rathmines was the first public library in Ireland to offer books for children. It was also the first library where, instead of requesting books, the public were allowed to browse. What a difference that must have made. How can you ask for something when you do not know that it exists? Hold that thought, and a story takes root. A story about a girl who dreams of becoming an artist, a dream she knows is way beyond her station. But she doesn't stop. She keeps drawing and painting until one day somebody, a teacher, notices and tells her she must not stop. You ask yourself, what will happen to this girl? Sitting in a sunlit nook of Rathmines Library, you start to write her story. You give her a mother, a father, and a brother. Her name, you decide, is Helen Grant, and she lives beyond the amusements in the seaside town of Tremor. 120 years after Andrew Carnegie laid the foundation stone for a public library in Waterford, yours is the most borrowed book in the county. You're invited to speak there on your birthday. It's the first time you've been in the grand limestone building on Lady Lane, and you wonder how many times you must have walked past it as a little girl without ever knowing what was going on inside.
This poem is called The Lost Key. And you know when you lose, I'm losing things more. And I go into this, this mindset. The Lost Key. I know if you knew when you lost it, you wouldn't be looking. Have you checked the back of the sofa? Underneath it? Could it be in your pockets? Have you checked your pockets? What about your pockets? What about there? In there? No, the insides of your pockets. Now, have you got any inside pockets? The insides of the inside. I mean your inside pocket. Inside your inside pocket. Have you checked the cupboards with the clothes in? The clothes, the new clothes, because you never know. Things turn up in the strangest. They do. They turn up. You have to check all of the pockets in all of the clothes of all of the places that you've ever been. That's a lot of pockets. Find out where the new land lies and the old lies land. It's funny, isn't it, how when you're looking, you find everything else? Except don't start blaming people. Before you know it, you'll accuse everyone that is nearest to you, everyone that was closest to you, that mattered. You'll turn on them, investigate them for the time they might have slipped it in their pockets and slipped away saying, goodbye, goodbye. Have you checked your pockets, your inside pockets?
Books. I love reading them, holding them, their weight, their smell. There's a Japanese word, tsundoku, for people who collect books just because they love the presence of them and because of the possibility that one day they'll open one and be transported to a different world. Archbishop Narcissus Marsh, who in 1707 opened Ireland's first public library, was a ferocious lover and collector of books. He sought, bought, and bequeathed an extraordinary collection of scholarly books, which to this day are held, conserved, and protected by Marsh's library's keepers and caretakers. They too love books, fiercely, and they execute their responsibilities with reverence and pride. Nowadays, anyone can go through the black iron gate behind St. Patrick's Cathedral, up the stone steps, and walk among dark oak bookshelves, still close stacked with Socrates, Aeschylus, Sterne, and Galileo, over 25,000 books on philosophy, theology, medicine and mathematics, witchcraft, poetry, music, and more. Some books can be requested for study within the library by scholars and researchers. More sit deep in shelves, with a metal bar across their spines, a drooping rope between them and their visitors. The lion's share of this precious collection is stored away from sight, a gargantuan process currently underway to share the contents of the books with future generations by capturing all 25,000 plus of them digitally. Many of them are enlivened by handwritten annotation, inkily threaded along margins, scribbled by centuries of readers. Jotted notes from Marsh himself, referencing and cross-referencing other books in his collection. Irascible editorial expletives from Jonathan Swift. There's a book raked with bullet holes from machine gun fire during the 1916 Rising. And James Joyce and Bram Stoker read at a wooden table that still sits in the center of the library. Readers of every discipline were locked in its small readers' cages to study through the night. Love letters were hidden among pages embellished with erudite and not so erudite 18th, 19th, and 20th century personal commentary. I've visited Marsh's many times, and when I walk between its shelves, inhaling the perfume of old paper and time, gaze upon rows of animal skin binding and gold leaf lettering, turn from a calligraphy practice desk towards readers' cages with Archbishop's mitres carved high above them, I think I can hear whispers of long-gone readers exchanging thoughts with those of writers before them, readers who may have been among the first people to trust the printed word to carry truth. Often I wish that I could enter that 300-year-long conversation. Wish I could turn a page that 300 years of readers have turned and stow a question in a margin for 300 years of future readers to run their fingertips over. Last week, in my local library, I lifted a huge book from a shelf, a heavy hardback about global warming called The Last Chance for Change. Its heft was awkward, but this was weighty matter, and it felt somehow congruent that I needed both hands to carry it back to the table. I turned back the front cover, flivveled the pages, felt the breath and ploof as they landed, till the book fell open on a dark two-page image, the words, "Our Changing World," a silver whisper in the corner. It was dramatic, a vast image of the bright lights of Earth seen from space. Fathomless black oceans implanted with midnight blue land masses, latticed with cobwebby white light trails. I brushed my fingertips over the surface of the paper, caressing the earth, the oceans, the continents. The smooth pages felt like satin. The fragrance of printed ink floated around me. Smell, sight, touch, imagination. It felt as if I'd never forget that image, or all that it implied about fragility and immensity. So completely did that moment, that encounter with that book, fill my senses. And then I thought of those protected volumes in Marsh's library, and I wondered, what exactly do books become when they aren't handled? How can those tactile, fragrant containers of thought fulfill the purpose for which they were made if they can no longer be touched, held, explored? Marsh's books, in their manifest vulnerability, have had to leave this conversation. They stimulated our ancestors' senses for hundreds of years. Now they must rest or die. We're too sensuous for them. Our heavy hands, warm breath, and quick heartbeat could cause them to perish entirely. Attended to by their small team of conservators, Marsh's books can still transport us, but they'll do it in a different way. Whatever their rich contents that we'll now read on computer screens, just through the presence of these beautiful books in this noisy, changeful time, through their quietness and fragility, they'll tell the story to a world that is passing, of a world that has passed.
Glan Mór Cluiche, le Bréag Chréibh Óm, ag fógar tacht an seach bhóthair N69 idir trá lí agus le stúthail, sin cultúrú. Behúnach ar chúl na carta, o mé theorú go ceantar dú halla, ar a hethe ón éanad freagarach ar málha, Phoning beog beedach in a gaulige, a raw. The only Irish I know is Sig Shees, agus na bia. Sin far cultúrha, sin tussa. I cnach mali mona, 8 euro a cown o llivin egan a carpac cun lashtir the hraig and fiersig. Energy exploitation because of prohibition. Shin kultur. It cannot heat or be a gandarov. A lassig suas laidcha and tandine. Tacht thilesh, na greyhounds a kohu, na kimad tesi yira, nisha sauce to dealas ra lamona. E clúdathe in blancéad múr, míltach, smútach, slach, a ha chó seanson go bhúis ag umpóin na rud beo sin cultúr. Ag siúl ar maidin, trís na portathe céanna na fúl cadagun món a bhintarta a hille, e bwint lán na súl as na canavan agus na bláthe na fianna, na fúl aumagum a nana malod a garlíne sin cultúr. Pe suen sata gom le haimshu e maskon dulra e la se agla a ha e tacht an vrasht an shing go wil rodegin se flanaka go wil nam wil te grihe agus la an lu ne tacht ni se yirra la e nig le shin kultur e gna lu slurry e stache moska voga is me fe yasa e gaglisha is a han fear Sin cultúr. E tuart ma chalín on orip, nach í ma chalín a hile í, hiú lód vrúch na haun, an son tos nín si a cahav amach ma jaul an blá, ach nílim se abat an blá a gál mar tam desensitize. Cadé sin? So a tuart istach an son fein malach an reste huarte, O hail achrenach na tuha, a tugan fochrum na lorries agus na kartacha wa vienig tomanchi chorp lar ma chomer si migraine de. Kade shin? So te ma chila vreinim biog ishke de. Ach an son kuiniim, a yil yaru da smakadi alli. A liana e gana siacht, an moga lam da ishke on tap. Atá long go barra the festicides agus the dodgy compounds. A beidir ná tuardach si é fé nara sin cultúr. Ach da húg si fé nara é, mar tóga chi a gyantar sléitach fír isca, agus an trónhóna son, balíon si lé, sean na vlasa rakosa, a súla mihe ná tegan to chile, e rá I love you. No mati bioga rim tu a rostal gabrach. Shin kultur.
Gramil maha gutta vihil.
Sanchev. How can part of him and Dave concertina exul? I'm going to play a tune for you on a very rare instrument. This is the bass concertina, and like the regular pitch concertina is up around here. This goes down to. Now, the grandparent of the concertina is this instrument. Are you familiar with this one? It's called an trumpa, as Gaelin. And it sounds like this. And it's about 2,000 years old. About 5,000 years old. It was found originally in archaeological sites in China, made out of wood and out of bone. But this is the grandparent of the concertina. These little trumpas are what makes up this instrument here, an organ bail, or the mouth organ. So when you breathe in and out of the organ bail, you get two different sounds. But a concertina is made up of three harmonicas side by side, one, two, three, cut in half, and continues on this side, one, two, and three. And instead of your lungs, you've got these lungs in the middle. So is anor more than Venza Hochan Porta Hemantive. I'm gonna play a tune that my ancestors played at the Battle of Kinsale to psych up the Begleys, the small warriors, to battle against the English in 1601. And it's called Marshal Inail, Marchlu Inail or O'Neill's March.
This morning's programme featured recordings from Sunday Miscellany's recent Culture Night celebration at Árasán Uachtaráin, hosted by President Higgins and Sabina Higgins. From that event, we heard Sun and Air by Nell Regan and Carnegie and Me by Angela Flannery. The Lost Key, a poem by Lem Sisse, was from a past Miscellany recorded at Glore in Ennis some years ago. Loving Books by Sharon Hogan was recorded at a previous Culture Night Miscellany in Collins Barracks in Dublin. And Sin Cultura Dó by Seamus Barra O'Sullivan was also from the recent event at the Áras. The music was Dialán Dé by Claire Sands, Enchantment composed by Eamon Cagney and performed by him with Niwelt Sumbu, A New Man by Django Reinhardt performed by Horace Hunka and Diane Daly, Oft in the Stilly Night by Thomas Moore, sung by Simon Morgan, accompanied by Martin Tourish, and O'Neill's March, played by Cormac Begley. On sound for RTE were Garrett Duffy and Liam Mullen, and our thanks to Kevin McCarthy and his team at Árasán Uachtaráin. Thanks also to sound engineer Gavin Muddyman. If you'd like to go along to the exhibition mentioned in Nell's script, Women Impressionists, it runs at the National Gallery of Ireland for just one more week. Have a look at nationalgallery.ie. And if you're interested in going to a live miscellany event, tickets for this year's Christmas miscellany with the RTE Concert Orchestra and special guests have just gone on sale. The lineup includes Joseph O'Connor, Maggie Armstrong and Paul Howard. And it's happening on the evening of Thursday, the 5th of December in the National Concert Hall. For tickets, go to nch.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back and find out more about the programme at rte.ie/radio or rte.ie/culture or on the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.